This audio interview is sponsored by the company that will help you hire your next great developer. It's called TopTal. And by the company that will allow you to close more sales. It's called PipeDrive. Here's the interview. Hey everyone, my name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. I'm really excited today because joining me is Damon John. He is one of the stars of Shark Tank, the incredibly popular show where entrepreneurs try to raise money from him and other investors. But you know, before that, I've heard of him and his company back when I worked for my dad's store as a kid on Myrtle Avenue in Brooklyn. I remember one day this guy walked into the store wearing a FUBU logo. And then a few days after that, it felt like everybody was walking around with a FUBU logo. And I heard someone say that FUBU stood for us, by us, which meant that my Persian dad who owned the store never fully understood it, let alone figured out how to actually get FUBU into our store. And I always remember how authentic that brand was, how people who wore it felt a sense of pride because they were in a club, they got it. And in this interview, I want to find out how he built up that company. I also want to find out about the investments that he made in Shark Tank and how he thinks about investing in companies. And I want to ask him about his latest company, which is Blueprint & Co. Blueprint & Co. is a co-working space where you get more than just a desk. It comes with the conveniences of cafes plus concierge and the support that founders get for marketing, funding, branding, and more. Damon, welcome.
Thanks for having me. I didn't know your dad had that store. That's a great intro.
Oh, yeah. Man, that I see that. It really made my dad understand he probably was never going to fully get it and should not have a store on Myrtle Avenue because things were changing.
No, of course not. You know, a lot of times, you know, people have thought that FUBU was purely only for a certain color, and it really wasn't. It was created for a culture. Mm-hmm. So whether it was Persian, white, you know, whatever the case was, it was created for those people who loved hip hop. And we were always an inclusive brand. You know, some people took it the wrong way and some people took it the right way. So I'm very proud of people like your dad who are entrepreneurs who help spread the FUBU word and the legacy. So tell dad I said thank you anyway.
I will. And you know what? What I didn't realize until I read your autobiography, Display of Power, was that you got LL Cool J to help promote it. Actually, LL Cool J gave you advice on how to promote it. He said you need to go after certain people like a crazy pregnant lady. What did he mean by that, and how did you end up working with him?
Well, you know, he lived in the neighborhood. We didn't really know him that well, but we were on tour with him, you know, because the whole neighborhood would go on tour, you know, and kind of push speakers around and go get the artist's lunch or get the band members lunch or whatever the case is. And, you know, when I came up with the idea, we went over to his house because we figured we needed our, you know, Michael Jordan of Nike. So we go over to his house and, you know, he gives me this great advice on how, you know, you have to go after all these artists and you have to kind of stalk them. And we figured there was no better artist to stalk than him. So we started doing that. And you know, honestly, though, of course, in the book, I have to fast forward and cut over some things. But the reality of it is the same way you opened up the conversation with, you saw one person walk in and look like everybody was wearing it. LL himself also had noticed that people in the neighborhood were wearing it, and the right people were wearing it, the people who had a passion about it, the people who are influencers just on a different level. And he felt safe in regards to wearing the product too, because it was kind of co-signed on by other people. So I think the moral of that story really is that, you know, you don't need to go after the LL Cool J's at first. Seed whatever you have with the people who are very passionate about it, and they will influence the bigger and better people that you may be trying to go after.
I see. And so it was first selling to the people who had the credibility and helped build your credibility. And then LL Cool J said yes. He wore the shirt. You took a photo of him. And then you used it at Magic, the big convention for the garment business. Did he get paid for that, for helping you guys?
No, he didn't. So he said, you know, I'm going to take a picture for you. And, you know, if you ever get anywhere. And he really didn't think we would, because, you know, it was never done at that scale before. He said, just take care of me. Mm-hmm. And we took 300, we made 300 copies of that picture and we sent it out. We mailed it to everybody prior to going to the show. Mm-hmm. So there was this anticipation that we were going to be somewhere at the show and they were looking out for us, you know, like all the small store owners. And we would end up later on inking a deal with LL Cool J, and thank God we did take really good care of him, because he took really good care of us. And I think that one of the main reasons that the brand became a global brand was due to his appeal and his, you know, authenticity in regards to supporting the product. He was not a person who would, you know, be paid by Pepsi and drink Coke. He lived the product.
So I talked to my audience. I said, what do you guys want to learn? And they said, you know, it's interesting about the early days, how Damon and the FUBU brand used to hustle at Black Expo and promote themselves on a small basis. But what we really want to know is how he grew it big, how he took it way beyond what it seems like an individual should be able to do. Magic, that show, that event seemed to be a big part of it. Can you talk about what you did there to help get more sales than you ever had before you went?
Well, you know, we basically, you know, so first of all, FUBU, I closed it down three times from 89 to 92 because I ran out of capital, but I only ran out of a small amount of capital. And then my friends came in and moved into my house, and we kind of, you know, try to put it all together. And by 95, that's when people started to see it around. And that's when we went to that big trade show, 94, mm-hmm. 95, something like that. We went to the trade show first. We walked the show. We didn't go and set up a booth. We didn't have enough money for it. So we got to see what was going on at the show. And then we went to the show again, and we did set up a booth, but we set up at the Mirage Hotel a couple of miles away from the trade show. And that is when I sent all those flyers to everybody, and there was the anticipation growing. So we proving the concept.
So it was the anticipation then that got people to make the trip to go see you, even though you weren't at the heart of the show.
Correct. And when they started to come to the hotel room, we wrote $300,000 in orders. And that was because there was this built up demand, which we call in the market proof of concept. Mm-hmm. And we were sprinkling the product out there, even though we didn't have enough to make the product for, you know, a large amount of people. But the beauty of music videos at that time is we took 10 shirts and we would just keep, you know, recycling the 10 shirts on a bunch of different videos. So people thought we were a huge brand. It's the same form with social media today. You know, everybody keeps seeing this stuff on Instagram. You build up this anticipation for it. So, you know, now we come back and, you know, we try to get financing from the banks. I get turned down by 27 banks. I turn my house into a factory. I take out as much money as we can on the house. I start manufacturing clothes because I didn't want to trust my money overseas because there was no Alibaba at that time. I didn't know what, you know, yeah. what to do and where to go. But now the next stage of proof of concept happens. We start selling to the stores. The stores start selling out of the goods. The stores themselves start telling manufacturers and producers and other brands, wow, this company is moving a lot of goods. And we made sure we only sold to a couple of small stores. And again, it's another form of proof of concept. You know, you see people come on the Shark Tank and they want to raise $1 million and sell to a bunch of stores. You don't. You just need small proof of concept. So whether it's that one cool kid in the neighborhood that LL Cool J looks at mm-hmm. and says, I like it, whether it's that one small store in, you know, in Queens, and then the bigger company started looking at it. And we just kept doing that on a different level and a different level. And then we had a distribution deal by Samsung.
So the distribution deal with Samsung, how did that work? How did Samsung help you guys grow?
So Samsung, so it's almost like any kind of factoring or manufacturing. So one Samsung took a look at us and said, you have $300,000 in orders. We're calling around to all the stores. They're saying that they can't keep this stuff on the shelves. They said, all right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to basically factor you. We're going to, if you bring in orders, say you bring in $1 million, $2 million, $10 million, $100 million, whatever the case is, mm-hmm. we're going to take a small percentage to manufacture and distribute the clothes. And then you're going to be able to take the rest of the money and you're going to be able to handle your marketing advertisement. You're going to handle your office, or, you know, your salaries, everything else. But we take a small piece for our servicing of manufacturing and producing. It's the same as the factory business. If you have what we call paper, you go and you have $1 million worth of orders from credible resources, meaning Macy's and Dillard's and all that type of stuff where they can, you know, check their credit, then a factory will give you 80% of the money and you will then go out and make the goods and, you know, and do what you need to do. So they basically underwrote our orders, our purchase orders.
I see. So it was them manufacturing it, not so much opening the doors. It was you guys opening the doors, getting companies, getting stores to sell it, and them manufacturing it and allowing you to afford to do that. Is that right?
Correct. And they weren't necessarily manufacturing. They were just financing the manufacturing because they were, it's like a bank. They were taking a percentage of it. Everything else uh-huh. was our job.
And this
every
was through
single thing else.
This was through this these two guys, Norman and Bruce, I think. Is that right?
Yeah. So Norman was the president of Samsung's textile division. It was just a small division of Samsung. Samsung may have 200 divisions. Everybody thinks about them for phones, but they may have everything from dog food to to textile division. So the textile division wasn't a big division of Samsung. Mm-hmm. Textiles were really what they were doing. They were basically making a bunch of white T-shirts and you know, and maybe coats and the no-name stuff, and they would probably private label it for people. So that's pretty much what they were doing. So now we had the ability to go in there and utilize their ability to make goods at a cheaper price or a more affordable price because they were running off massive amount of raw goods. And we were able to put our stamp and our identity on it and go out and market and brand and sell all the goods.
So what did you do to get more stores to carry your brand?
Well, we would have to – at that point, we would have to scale slowly. We would have to – you know, at first, the big department stores wouldn't touch our brand. They didn't know if Urban was really going to be what it was at the time. And then, you know, by the time one person who had a specialty store, you know, in the neighborhood, by the time, you know, 2 years would pass and they had seven because FUBU and Kalk and I and all these other brands were doing so well – the big stores started to say, wait a minute, we need to get onto this. But it started to scale that quick. And, you know, now we're talking about FUBU from 96 all the way to 2000. It was a massive run because every year we would take on another 100 or 200, 300 stores. Then we would start to license out territories internationally. We would start to go into Japan and South Africa and Brazil and Mexico and things of that nature. And you know, we brought on people who understood licensing. I mean, at the end of the day, when you start to scale, you need to just bring on executives and or people who've been in that position before and they know how to scale.
What percentage of the business did you end up owning?
And what percentage of the business did we end up owning?
Yeah, I mean, you personally.
Me, the whole brand. Oh, I wouldn't tell you that. That's
really?
Company, yeah. Are you kidding me? How much money do you have in the bank right now?
Oh, that's a good question. I see what you mean.
There you go. Isn't that a great question?
What about this then? I've seen you say that it was a $6 billion brand. Do you say what the annual revenues are?
No, because over the course of the years, we did about $6 billion in sales. The annual revenue would fluctuate. It would obviously go to $50 million, go as high as $300, $350 million.
Okay.
And then it would go down, you know, $200 million, $100 million, $50 million, so it would fluctuate.
And you still own it today, a piece of it anyway, right?
Yeah, we still own the brand today.
Okay. At this point, I'll take a quick break from the interview to tell you about a sponsor whose software enables us to get Damon John and people like him on Mixergy. It's called Pipedrive. Pipedrive is software that's built to help salespeople and sales organizations close more deals. It forces you to get clear on the steps you need to take to close your sales. Maybe step one is to find potential customers. Step two is to email those customers. Step three, well, you know, all the way down to the final step, which is closing the deal. Then every time you sit in front of Pipedrive, you see all your steps easily laid out and you know who's sitting at what step of the sales process. And your job is to think about, how do I move them along? Do I send more emails? Do I make another phone call? Do I follow up? Pipedrive keeps it organized. And it's not just you who's doing it. As you scale up, other people on your team could collaborate, sit at the same dashboard and help you move people to the finish line, which is closing a deal. We use it to get people on Mixergy. That's closing a deal for us, and also to close more sales, and it'll help you close more sales too. If you want to try it, they have a special URL just for us where they will give you free time to use Pipedrive and actually close some sales so that you can see how powerful and organized the software is. Go check them out at pipedrive.com/Mixergy. That's pipedrive.com/Mixergy. All right, back to the interview. Then you got into Shark Tank. Was it – I remember talking to Barbara Corcoran, who told me that she was turned down from Shark Tank and she went to Mark Burnett's office and she convinced him to change his mind and have her on. What was it like for you to get on Shark Tank? How did you get on there?
I turned Shark Tank down. Barbara got turned down by Shark Tank. I'm not sure why. I think they had a couple of people in that they were considering. But when I first got the call, I said – this is crap. Nobody's going to watch five business people talking about business. Who? And then they told me that Mark Cuban was going to be on it. And I said, and I didn't know Mark at the time. I said, the big head guy that likes to throw chairs on the
basketball court.
Yeah. The guy who has more money than God and can be on TV anytime he wants. I said, that's crap. He's not going to be on the show. And he wasn't on the first year. And I was like, on the first season, I was like, you guys are just full of it. So I said, I don't really think I'm going to do the show. And then they told me that I couldn't do any other show but theirs. And I was in charge of the product integration for the Kardashians for their first 3 years. And I had already promised the girls that I was going to be on their show a couple of times, not just three separate times. And then Shark Tank said I couldn't do that either. So I said, all right, well, then I'm not going to do the show. Khloe Kardashian found out that I was going to turn down Shark Tank because of her. And she said she would never get in my way. So she asked me not to be on her show. So now all of a sudden I'm considering going on the Shark Tank. But then I said to myself, you know what? I'm only going to do it if I can pitch Mark Burnett my show ideas, because I have some really, really good show ideas. So I'll go out there and I'll shoot the stupid show that's never going to work, and I'll get to pitch Mark Burnett. So I go out there, I shoot the show, they pick up the pilot, and then I finally get to pitch Mark Burnett my three show ideas. And he shot them down in like 30 seconds apiece. They were all garbage. But I stayed on Shark Tank, so that's how it worked out.
That garbage was his opinion, or now your opinion in retrospect?
Well, I think both of our opinion. Even when I was pitching him, I was like, "Man, these are crappy ideas."
But what were you doing with the Kardashians? What does it mean that you were doing products with them, or what were you doing with products?
Product
with them?
Integration. So the girls, I was in charge of all the brands you would see in the girls' show for the first 3 years, and I was in charge of some of their sponsorships and
And they were getting paid for these brands, and you helped select them and make those deals?
Correct.
I see. Wow, which kind of makes sense, because you're the guy who used to hustle outside of video shoots and get your FUBU clothes on artists, and then, like you said earlier, take them, have them cleaned, and then worn by the next artist. So I see. What a coming full circle.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, they did that because probably around from 2000 to 2007, I probably did most of the product integration you'll see in music videos. I was probably in reality shows and music videos. I was probably putting, whether it's my product, another car company or liquor company, I probably put products in about 250 videos every year. So everybody in the industry knew me for that, because, you know, that was my form of guerrilla marketing.
So what I'm wondering is, what happens after you make a deal on Shark Tank? I've heard that as many as 30% of the deals actually don't go through. Is that right?
It all depends. You know, season one, I think 30% of the deals did go through and 70 fell through. I think season two went up to 40% closing, 50% closing. I close approximately 80% of the deals now. Mm-hmm. The deal started to get better because, first of all, season one, season two, the companies weren't that great. The show wasn't that well known. Also, the Sharks, we didn't have our staff that every year we hired two more people to help manage these things. So we all got better and better and better as the show, as the show proceeded.
And when at first a deal didn't happen, what would keep it from happening? Is it that the numbers that somebody shared on television were wrong? Is it that you guys just couldn't keep up with the deal? What was going on?
No, there could be anything. I mean, listen, you know, when you see the show, that pitch could be an hour, or that pitch could be 2.5 hours. You just see 8 minutes of it. We're sending a bunch of questions at these people, and we make best efforts to close the deal. Now, afterwards, I may say to somebody, I'm told you owe $1 million in taxes. And I would say, why didn't you tell us, that when we were asking you questions? They were like, well, you didn't ask that question. So it could be that. We could find out that they thought they had a trademark, but their ex-wife really owns the name of the company, or they never really registered it. So it could be so many different things. Or we just don't like them, or they don't like us.
I see.
The number could be great, but then you find out the person morally is not the person you want to deal with, or maybe they just don't like us. So it can be various different things, but to close on 80% of those deals is extremely good, because in the venture world, you usually close on only 20% of deals.
You know, I'm just amazed that you can keep up with all of it. I shouldn't be so shocked because I read your story. I mean, as a kid, you're a guy who used to do everything from like drive a car service, your own personal yeah. car service, following the buses, used to sell super squirt guns, used to sell hats, used to do constantly have you sold your mom. This was shocking to me. Your mom gave you condoms when you went to camp. You took them and you sold them instead of using them, which is such a hustler move.
Uh-huh. Well, it's not a hustle move. It means that I wasn't getting that lucky at camp, so I had to do something, right?
Did you not have your swagger at that point? It seemed like your mom thought that you were old enough too. Did you not have your swagger?
I did, but you didn't want to see the potential people to I spend see. The swagger on. So trust me, it was worth staying doing what I did.
So what I'm wondering is, how do you now manage all these different investments that you make through Shark Tank? You mentioned that you are hiring extra people to help, but can you give me an overview of the way you manage so many investments?
Yeah, so it is very hard. It's time consuming. And, you know, you have to think about it like this. Some of the investments, if I have, let's say, 80 investments, let's say 20 of them are kind of just chugging along or laying dormant because they're, you know, they're 8 years old and they haven't been doing that great. Mm-hmm. You have another 20 of them that have excellent CEOs and operators who damn near don't need me. You know, I'm there when they need me, but they are operators that I'm probably learning more from than they're learning from me. And then you have the ones that are a little more active. They're kind of in that middle area, mm-hmm. And they need a little push and a little love here and there. And we need to work with them. So, I mean, they're not all just heavy, you know, daily calls and things of that nature. But, you know, we also have 20 people that also service them and then bring – they're like department heads. And they bring them all to me at a certain point. We review them and we work with them. But, you know, it is time consuming. But at the end of the day, I mean, that's just the way business is. And it's taken still 8 years to really get up and get this system going. And it's every day you got to improve the system.
What is your personal system for being productive? I've heard your phrase rise and grind, which I freaking love. Yeah. What's your system for staying on top of stuff?
My system is, first of all, goal setting. Mm-hmm. Also maximizing your time as much as you can, you know, so, we're doing this podcast. I wouldn't be able to do this if I was at the office because I need that time to have the face-to-face interaction. I'm here in Albuquerque, New Mexico at the moment, and I'm going to knock out things like this and my emails here instead of, you know, when I'm there, I'm going to prioritize things. I'm also going to make sure that I have good management. Good management is almost the most important thing. People who are problem solvers, you know, by the time they come to me with a problem, they've already had 10 different ways that they've tried to solve it. And then I'm going to be the last resort. And they're going to say, all right, we have two more ways to try it. Which one do you want to do? So, you know, it's really about good management and good execution around you.
You know what? I noticed that. So the guy who helped book this interview, Ethan, that guy called me up today, an hour before the interview, called me up 20 minutes before the interview. And this is like to make sure that everything was in line. We were not going to waste a second of your time. I always love seeing that kind of operation.
Yeah, now people who are very methodical about the things and they stay on it, they're essential. You know, you look at somebody who's a boss and everybody thinks a boss is like Batman and everybody's Robin, but most of the time I'm Robin. You know, if I hire somebody to do something and I trust them, then I need to follow their lead as well.
What's the biggest mistake you made with your investments?
It's hard to say one big mistake, but the two general mistakes is number one, not trusting your gut. Mm-hmm. No matter how good things may seem, if you don't trust your gut is really going to tell you, you know, how you feel about it. And number two is homework. You know, not really investigating what you should, you know, about it. So, you know, those are the two things I think. And trusting your gut really, it means do you have a passion, whether about the person or about the product. And every time that I failed, it all came back to three separate things. Mm-hmm. It came back to number one, I didn't do enough research on it. Number two, I didn't spend enough time on it. And number three, I didn't put the right people around it. And all of that really comes back to your gut and loving it and having passion. Because number one, if you were passionate about it, then you would have spent way more time on it because you would have been happy about it, or you would have spent way more time researching it because it would have been fascinating to you, or you would have went out of your way and found the right people. But if you didn't have your passion, your gut told you not to do it, then, you know, that's usually why it fails.
I've got a list of all the investments you made on Shark Tank. Is there one that you were especially excited about that you maybe spent more time than you should have as an investor because you're so passionate about the product?
You know what? It's like trying to pick your favorite kid.
It won't be like a favorite kid, just one example that gives us an illustration of how you feel about a lot of your kids.
Titan Vest, I spent a lot of time on. Bubba Baker's boneless ribs and Bombas socks. Those three are all in different areas, and those three are the ones I spend a lot of time on. And
I see Titan because you work out so much, and it feels like such a natural fit.
Yeah, and entrepreneur Patrick is a great entrepreneur, and I loved and I think that it. I had suffered from a double hernia because I was wearing some of those weighted vests that really didn't do anything besides give me a double hernia. So I think I related to the product so much, and that's why I love it, and I love the entrepreneur.
I see.
So yeah, it's something that I resonated with.
Once again, I'll take a small break from this interview to tell you about a company called TopTal. You know, if you listen to this interview, you might hear me mention Barbara Corcoran, and maybe you'll go back to the site and search for her to find her interview. Well, if you were to do that a few years ago, you couldn't find her interview or anything else because I'm pretty prolific. As I scaled up to over 100, then hundreds, then over 1,000 interviews, it became really hard to find content on my site. So I knew that TopTal has the top 3% of developers on the planet. I went to them and I said, here's my problem. Here's the ideal solution. Can you find a great developer to build this for me? And TopTal went to their network. They found someone who's phenomenal. I didn't have to tell them how to solve the problem. I just had to say, here's the problem and here's my ideal. And that developer really built something phenomenal that today allows you to search through the transcripts, through the site, and really find things in an organized way. Bring your best project, your best problem, your most important task to TopTal. They will find you the right developer to work part-time, full-time, or even a team of developers. It's called TopTal. Top as in top of the mountain, Tal as in talent. And there's a special URL, as you might have imagined, where they're giving you something that they're not giving anybody else. Mixergy listeners will get 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when they pay for their first 80 hours. And that's in addition to a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks. Bring your biggest project, your biggest problem, your biggest engineering challenge to toptal.com/mixergy. Top is on top of the mountain, tal is in talent, toptal.com/mixergy. Let's get back to the interview. You know, you mentioned goal setting earlier. I know that you work with Catherine of bestself.co, the journal that helps people set goals and stay on top of them. I'm wondering what your goal setting process is.
My goal setting process? My goal setting process started when I was 16 years old, when I first read the amazing book, Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. Mm-hmm. And my goal setting process is I have 10 goals that I read 5 times a week, every single night, out of those 5 times and every single morning. When I read them at night, it's the thing I think about when I'm sleeping. When I wake up in the morning, I read them in the morning. I usually take action on those goals first, whether it's making a call, whether it's in the right direction, or whether it's drinking a green drink, because I said that I'm going to drink one green drink a day, right, to keep my health up. The goals, six of them expire in 6 months, and the other three, no, seven, seven of them expire in 6 months, and the other three, one expires in 5 years, one expires in 10 years, one expires in 20 years. The seven that expire in 6 months, when the 6 months come up, I reset them and I set them again. So whether it's getting down to the ideal weight, whether it's spending more time with my kids and my family, I just keep resetting them to make sure that it's something that's on my mind daily.
I see. And it's always a set of 6 month goals.
Always a set of 6 month goals, because what happens is, you can visualize that they need to be done within this time. And when this, when the 6 months is coming around, I feel this kind of like anxiety or something's happening. It pushes like this pressure on me and I don't realize why until bang, oh, wait a minute, those are my goals.
What's the one that's 20 years in the future?
one to 20 years in the future is where will I be 20 years in the future? And to visualize where you will see yourself.
Where do you see yourself 20 years from now?
Oh, you asked me so much personal crap. No,
is it too personal? It's a big goal. Yeah, help us bring us in.
No. It's looking at a certain place. You know, my personal one is a house that I visualize with a beach, how my kids will look around me, how my grandkids will look around me, and those things. It's not something that is a materialistic thing.
And you will visualize it. And you have them in your mind's eye.
And it's to have health. Yes. It is the way you look in 20 years from now with your health, with your family, with whether you're spiritual person you want to be around, or maybe I'm going to turn into the guy with a million cats around me. I don't know. But
what about a dollar amount? I know Napoleon Hill used to talk about being that clear. Do you get that clear about your net worth or your revenue or anything like that?
No, I don't. I do not get that clear about that. I used to when I was much younger. I used to come up with a dollar amount, but I don't do it anymore.
Blueprint
because
and Co.
Revenue is not in the goal.
It's not
in any of my goals. No,
that's shocking. I would have thought that that would be a big one for you, but I get it.
No, not at all.
Yeah. You know what? You wrote this really moving piece a while back. I'll let people go and get it, about how you made so much money and how it affected your family life. It actually hurt your family life, and you were really open about that. And I could understand with that in the background why you'd want to think beyond just revenue.
Well, you know what? I think that I learned a long time ago, like you said, about the moving piece. But I learned that that there's not a number that will make – well, to me, but I've never met a person that had a number that would make them happy. Once they achieved the number they thought would make them happy, then they had this kind of emptiness in them because they realized that it didn't buy them anything that they wanted. So I think that that's probably it. I mean, because success is not money. I always say it. Success drives you up to your problems in a limousine. And somebody asked me the other night, it was a paparazzi. He was outside and had the camera in my face and he was like, how does it feel to be rich? And I said, is wealthy being successful? And he said, yeah. I said, well, doesn't that just drive you up to your problem in a limousine? He said, but I would really rather drive up to my problems in a Ferrari. I said, yeah, well, what if your problem was you had stage 2 cancer? Is that going to help you? Is that Ferrari going to help you? And then he put down the camera and he left me alone.
What happened to Grimm? Wasn't Grimm supposed to be the guy keeping these kinds of people away from you? Your bodyguard?
Yeah, and he is he's still my bodyguard, but he moved over into logistics in my company because you know even big guys like that have dreams and aspirations, and I'm no longer the young guy running around in the urban scene with a lot of jewelry on me because that was part of the promotion. Plus, I was young and I had, I was wearing a lot of jewelry and that was a certain stage in my life. And, I want people to feel like they can approach me. That's why I call myself the people shark. What are they going to do? Approach me? And all people do when they approach me is just tell me how they want to help feed their families and their hopes and their dreams. I don't need a bodyguard to push them away. I want to actually hug most of them when I talk to them.
Wow. You know what? It's so interesting to just hear you talk this way because I think I have a different vision of you. I have a vision of you as a hustler who, in my mind, you probably are sewing something right now as we're talking or signing contracts, just reading what you did.
I am hustling, but right now I'm hustling right now because you and I are on a podcast, right? And
we're yes.
Gonna share, my concepts or whether it's Blueprint and Cole, whether it's my history, right? And at the end of the day, that'll get people to know me other than the guy they see on Shark Tank in a 3-piece suit where I'm edited purely as a business guy, because a lot of people want to know what goes on behind that. So I did take the time and you took the time to interview me. So people know it's still a hustle no matter what.
Yeah. I want to close out with just asking you about Blueprint and Co.
Sure.
Tell me about this. Why create this? What's the hole in the market that you're filling?
Yeah, so Blueprint & Co. is a co-working shared space. There's a lot of co-working shared space out in the market, and I found that nothing fit me. Nothing fit me where maybe I wanted to meet with an Andrew, I wanted to meet with a Cuban, or meet with somebody else. There are ones for startups, which I think are great, and it's called the Power Broke. If you're a startup, you need to go to some of the ones out there. Don't go build a huge office. Go to some of those co-working shared space, but I myself, with Damon John, it's a little too young for me. I can't go and find the right people that I need there to hopefully find best practices and work with. There's also the private clubs, whether it's a cigar lounge, whether it's golf clubs or a golf resort or whatever the case is, or some of those, the athletic clubs, some of those clubs where people are socializing. I can't park two or three of my top innovative people over there because people are there drinking and partying and relaxing. Mm-hmm. They're not trying to do business. So I needed a place that I can go where I can see, you know, like I'll give you an example who's coming into Blueprint & Co. There is the CEO of Ashley Stewart is putting four or five of his top people over there. And these are very innovative people that he already has probably 80 or 90 people working in his core office, but he wants those people to be around like-minded people like myself. Lisa Mattress, the people who are delivering mattresses right to your door, they want their public relations and or people there. I have photographers there. I have, you know, JetSmarter is putting, you know, taping a couple of desks. So when their executives come in on their private jets, they have a place to work. So I needed to develop a place where I can go and see other like-minded seasoned executives such as myself and work with them and you know, share best practices and network. And that's what I created.
So this isn't for the new entrepreneur who wants to hustle. This is for the person who's got a real business and needs a professional place to keep growing it.
Correct. So this is for – there's corporations in there that are Fortune 1000 corporations who are saying, you know what? We can't get our good talent. We can't get innovative talent to come all the way out to the suburbs or into Jersey. So we want to park five people there because they're innovative and we want them to see what's going on from social media conversion mm-hmm. all the way over to processing and coding. And then there's people such as myself who are like, all right, I have 100 people working over here, but I need to park 10 people over there, or I need to go there myself and work with people. So that's the type of people that we have there. It's not for a startup.
You know what? I hear what you're saying about these co-working spaces. I looked at so many of them. The thing that bothers me about it is how much they pitch you on how much partying they'll be doing over there. You'll get to Correct. Meet people because we're going to have beer nights. I'm not looking for another place to have beer night. I want a place to get stuff done.
Exactly. So, and that's a prime example. Like, you know, we will have people there who are purely there to get stuff done. And if we have something, maybe there's wine, but it's not beer night. Like my, you know, next week I'll be doing a one-on-one with Gary Vaynerchuk, and we will be talking about not startups. We're going to be talking about where do we see business going and what's keeping us all up at night. The next night I'm going to have all the sharks there and we're going to be talking about some stuff. It's not going to be super high level, but it's going to be talking about what are we doing with
our investments. They're coming to Blueprint & Co. to the office on 39th Street.
They're coming to Blueprint & Co. to the office on 39th Street. And then by the time, you know, I'm tapping into my full Rolodex. So I'm bringing things there that I want to see. I want to see me interview Seth Godin one-on-one.
Oh, yeah.
Or you know, Randy Zuckerberg and talk about from creating Facebook with her brother all the way to where she's transitioning now and where do we see business going. So those are the type of individuals there. No ping pong, no beer night, no Twister. None of that stuff happening. It's about getting it done. And I want to now open these up in London and in California. I don't want to do 9,000 lunches in dinners in California. I want to see everybody at the same exact time, yeah. You know, when I can, you know?
Yeah, the place is right in the heart of Manhattan, 39th Street off of between 7th and 8th Avenue, I think, right?
Correct.
Cool. You know, let me close out with this. Do you do any kind of meditation practice or anything like that? It feels like you're very well grounded and very focused despite all the chaos around you.
Well, you know, goal setting is a form of that because mm-hmm. when you goal set, you basically zone out and you have to not only just read these things, you have to visualize these things. So that is my closest form of that. And then I'm an outdoors person, so I go – you know, whether it's snowboarding or whether it's fishing, whenever I can, I take that time, whether anything to do with the beast. But really goal setting is my daily practice of getting to meditate.
All right. Well, if anyone wants to go check out the website, it's blueprintandco.com. Well, thanks so much for being on here.
Well, I appreciate it.
Good meeting you.
Great talking to you, man. All right, man.
Thanks. Bye, everyone. And there's the interview. If you like what you heard here and you want more stories from proven entrepreneurs who get into the details of how they built their businesses, I urge you to subscribe to this podcast via iTunes or whatever podcast app you like. When you do, you'll get the latest interview complete with stories of how people have built their businesses. You'll get it all directly delivered to your phone or other device. Just go into your favorite podcast app, subscribe to Mixergy, M-I-X-E-R-G-Y. And thanks for listening.